It's just 12 o'clock, and you are tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM, and around the world on internet on cooperadio.org. And coming up right now on Co-op Radio is the Animal Voices Show, and here they come. They're shuffling into the studio. Hang on.
Welcome to Animal Voices, the weekly show dedicated to informing listeners about animal issues and increasing compassion for all living creatures. In the studio with me today are co-host Carl Loskin, technician Alan Jensen, and two very special guests, Bill and Linda Gannon. They are environmentalists who are working to prevent future pollution of BC coastal waters. Their work dates back to 1977, when they campaigned with Greenpeace to save the whales by preventing a port for super freighters being constructed at Kitimat, BC. That campaign, fortunately, was successful, but 30 years later, they are again, or perhaps still, striving to prevent pollution in our waters. This time from an oil pipeline running from Alberta tar sands to Kitimat, where the oil will be loaded and put onto super tankers that will then transport it to distant ports. Bill and Linda Gagnon will be informing us about the anti-pipeline campaign very shortly. They have even composed a song which they're going to sing to us, so we're looking forward to that. It's called BC Waters. Now, Carl, you have a guest coming on at 12:30. Maybe you could tell us about her.
Yes, we have Barbara Cartwright, and she's the campaign manager for the International Fund for Animal Welfare based in Ottawa, ifaw.org. And we'll be talking about the ivory trade and the wonderful elephants that are in many parts of Africa.
Thank you. That certainly sounds interesting. Now, let's get started with Bill and Linda Gagnon. Perhaps, Bill, you would start us off by giving us a little idea about this pipeline issue, okay?
Okay. Well, back in February of this year, Enbridge is an oil company, and they've announced that they're going ahead with their $4 billion plan to build a pipeline from Edmonton to Kitimat, and where they're going to plant, they're planning to build a super port in the it's a private port of Kitimat, privately owned. They're building a super port for these giant-sized, very large super tankers that they're planning to fill up with oil from the pipeline and take the super tankers down through these treacherous fjords. They're very narrow fjords, and they run 200 kilometers to the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
And it runs through 9 provincial parks, and all kinds of animals are going to be affected by this. I mean, we've got eagles, we've got bears, whales, fish.
Why are they aiming at Kitimat once again? It's probably the shortest route.
Probably the shortest route, the most dollars that they can squeeze out of Alberta. And they're turning BC into Alberta's back alley, I think.
And other than that, there's no justification for choosing that spot, I'll bet, is there?
No. There's a tanker exclusion zone that's been in effect since 1988, and that was 100 kilometers off the shore of Alaska and BC that has been respected. It was agreed upon by the Canada and the U.S., and they've respected that until now, where they're... The government have come back. The conservative government have said that they interpret that as being a vertical zone. The reason it's 100 feet, 100 kilometers off the coast is because they can't get rescue ships up there in time if when there's going to be an oil spill. They need to be. By the time they get, it takes 37 hours to get the rescue boats up there, and by that time the oil will be on shore, which is why they made it 100 kilometers offshore.
Now they're cutting
across it, and the Canadian government says, "Well, that's a vertical zone; it's not a horizontal zone."
That's a joke.
It is, and you'll have to talk to Harper and the minister, Gary Lunn, Minister of the Environment, about that.
But even if it were possible to get up there in a shorter period of time, all the oil out in the Pacific is going to be very, very harmful to wildlife and people and everything else.
I just don't understand why they don't keep the oil on the continent. Why is the U.S. and Canada taking oil in from Saudi Arabia when we have it in Alberta? Why are we shipping it over to Japan? It just doesn't make any sense.
And actually, you brought up something interesting, which was the that as of NAFTA, remember the agreement that you were telling me about, that they have to keep, it's by agreement that they have to, even if we run out of oil, that the oil has to be, we cannot keep it internally. We still have to ship it to the United States.
Yes, that's correct. I believe there is an agreement there that that by agreement we have to supply the needs of the United States, the contracts that they have, even if Canada is short of oil for its own use. It's just totally insidious.
Yeah, you know, actually, one of our questions was, With the green intention in mind, why don't they just keep all of the oil in North America? We've seen diagrams. We saw this on CNN. They have pipelines going from the state, from Canada, from the tar sands, all going to different parts of the United States. We were just wondering why don't they? And I'm sure Canada also needs the oil. We're not against people using petroleum. It's just that
I believe that our government is at fault because we don't have a Canadian energy policy. And that's why we need to speak to our politicians like you do, loud and clear.
Right. Well, I've come up with a way to do that, and it's the most effective way. I've been, for the last year, I've been digging into who's responsible, who gets to approve this. And it turns out, from my investigation so far, nobody. There's not a single person in the Canadian government who can say, no, we don't want a super tanker coming up these dangerous waters to Kitimat. Mm-hmm. And the only way to stop them is with a law. We have to pass a law. And that's in progress. The Dogwood Society, Dogwood Initiative in Victoria, have a petition going right now, and it's online, and you can sign it. And it's at notankers.ca, www.notankers.ca. And if you sign the petition, when we get 30,000 signatures, it's going to be taken into the Canadian Parliament. And then, when it's read out in Parliament, we'll find out which of the politicians who say they're green are really green, because they'll have to vote for it if they're green.
And this is strictly a federal matter.
It's a federal matter. Uh-huh. Department of Transport and the Department of Fisheries, the Canadian Coast Guard, mm-hmm. are passing the buck back and forth as to who's responsible. And they're both saying it's the other guy.
I see.
And no one is responsible.
Yeah. And I know you're concentrating on the water issue, but it's the dangerous thing anyway, isn't it?
Oh, totally.
Putting a pipeline right across that fragile section of our continent.
Right, there's all kinds of wildlife affected by that.
Absolutely.
So then, we were all hypocrites because we all drive. We all use, even public transportation uses petroleum. Mm-hmm. So we all have to, go greener. Buy air cars or whatever.
That's the ultimate answer, is cutting down on consumption.
Right. That's right.
It's not an easy thing to get people to do. Right. But I read some good news just the other night in the Globe and Mail about the decreasing amount of driving going on. There's a certain mm-hmm. drop. Yeah. Very recently. The price had to get extremely high for gasoline before people started quitting mm-hmm. driving, yep. putting their cars in the garage. Very nice. Kitimat is a totally unsuitable place. We know that because of this. It's right at the top of a 200-kilometer fjord.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that...
It's a labyrinth of fjords going all over the place. And by the way, up there, the tides rise and fall 30 feet a day. Can you imagine oil in a narrow fjord going up and down 30 feet a day with the tides? It's going to make a mess of the whole inside waters of BC. It'll go everywhere before they get rescue boats up there to stop them.
It takes
37 hours to get up there.
Yeah. Where are the destinations, the primary destinations for this oil?
China and India, mostly. I mean, they talk about California, but they can get to California on land by pipeline.
Yes.
They don't need super tankers for that.
Sure, sure. Now, give us an idea about these super tankers, will you, Bill?
Well, these are, a typical one is about 1,000 feet in length, which is the length of 3 football fields, if you can imagine 3 football fields, and 150 feet wide, and they carry 350 million gallons, or barrels of crude oil.
350 million.
They're just huge. It's
unthinkable.
Too big to imagine.
Can you compare that to the Exxon Valdez?
Well, it'll be the same size as the Exxon Valdez. Very same operation.
Okay, so we know what a disaster that was.
Well, we do. It's been nearly 20 years. It's been 19 years since the Exxon hit the rocks. And they clean up. They claim they cleaned up 15%, and they claim that's enough. That's a success to have only cleaned up 15%. And the 15% that is, quote, cleaned up, if you look at the beaches are now asphalt, because that's what happens when you use a power washer and into sand with oil. It turns into asphalt. And so now we have asphalt beaches and 15% of it. And the other 85%, there's the tar balls that roll up with the tide. And they roll up on the beach. And each time they roll up on the beach, they pick up any the things that happen to be alive still, and they get rolled into the tar ball, and they go back down, and then they roll up again. And I spoke to the woman who was in charge of the cleanup, and she said that the smell of death and crude oil is just so overwhelming that when she got to the site the first day, she just wept, got down on her knees and cried.
Is that the end of the cleanup then?
That's 15%. They're not cleaning anymore up. No, that's done.
Where's the Canadian government in that?
Right, so you'll have like the Alberta tar sands and the BC tar balls.
Yeah. And the concrete beach or the blacktop
asphalt beaches.
Yeah, terrible, terrible. Anyway, let's go on. There are other. You've already mentioned one group that's working on this issue.
The Dogwood Initiative.
Living Ocean Society is also working on this. Mm-hmm. Greenpeace is. It's on their agenda, but things take a long time to work at Greenpeace. And we probably won't be seeing any direct action from them for about another year.
Oh, really?
But, yeah.
And it's already underway, this pipeline.
They started last February. They gave it the go-ahead. There's nothing stopping it.
In the ground? Is it already in the ground?
I haven't been able to actually get up to Alberta to see where they are. But
sorry, this is oil coming from where?
From the Alberta oil sands.
Right across through northern BC, through past Jasper and across past Prince George and then out to Kitimat, right?
Yeah,
it's extraordinary that it doesn't go south. Yeah, this is what you were talking about this earlier, but the more you think about it, the more bizarre it is. When you've got the pipeline system already there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand the free trade agreement says that we only have to send 60% of our oil to the United States. So we're committed to that. But so the oil companies are saying, well, where do we send the other 40%? And there's more money for the oil companies, and they don't give a damn about these.
Yeah, they couldn't
Coast.
Dream of leaving it in the ground, right? I mean, for future generations?
No.
So this Enbridge company, it's the builder, is it, of the pipeline?
Yeah, that's right.
And that company has put a lot of money and is putting a lot of money into it, isn't it?
Putting $4 billion with a B. And there's more projects headed towards Kitimat. There's $10 billion worth of work committed to turn Kitimat, the dying town of Kitimat. It used to have 12,000 people, and a few years ago they had the greatest population drop of any city in Canada, any town in Canada. They dropped down. They're now around 8,500. And the mayor is all excited about the $10 billion worth of work that's going to come up to his town so they can ruin our coast. I think it's criminal.
Who owns Enbridge?
Shareholders and possibly a lot
public,
of Chinese.
It is public company.
Public company, yeah.
Oh, yeah, and a lot of Chinese ownership.
Well, that's what I understand, yeah.
Yeah, so there might be a lot of other export. I mean, that's maybe one reason why they've invested
heavily to
China.
Exactly, but there's safer ways to do it, and that putting super tankers in BC waters is not the answer.
Yeah. Those super tankers, they're so huge, they'd be very, very slow to respond,
well,
I would think.
It takes them 40 minutes to stop.
So, yeah, you know, Bill has a website, bcwaters.org.
bcwaters.org. That's all, I've got all the facts about this.
And you can take a tour, actually. He'll let him tell you about it.
Well, if you have Google Earth, you don't have Google Earth installed in this computer, do you?
No.
Okay. Well, it's a very great program, and you get to see the Earth. And from my website, if you click onto it, it'll take you to Kitimat, and then down at the level of 1,000 feet high. It'll take you down through the fjords, and it takes a few minutes. It takes 5 minutes to go through the whole course, but you'll see how dangerous it is. I mean, it's a very, very, very scary thing they're doing. They're going past, in the middle of Douglas Channel, there are a couple of rocks, big rocks that stick out, and they're provincial park. It's called Rock Park, and it's a provincial park, one of the 10 provincial parks. But these things are sticking, big rocks sticking up out of Douglas Channel. And they're going to have super tankers. And they say these super tankers are going to be escorted by tugboats. Now, I've talked to fishermen who work up there. And they've said there are nights where a tugboat wouldn't think of going out in that weather. But these super tankers are nonstop. They have to. They can't turn off the tap. They've got to keep these super tankers moving. And they will go through any kind of weather. And somehow they say these tugboats are going to come out, and when the winds get up to over 200 kilometers an hour and they got raging storms where no fishermen will go out in the water, super tankers are going to be out there. There's going to be six a week.
That's a financial consideration, surely.
Yeah,
strictly. A lot of our society is driven by financing.
Let me add to that. You mentioned financial considerations. This thing of Exxon, when Exxon, the thing happened, they were fined punitive damages of $5 billion. They fought that in the courts, and about 15 years after that was decided, it was reduced to only $2.5 billion. And then a few weeks ago, it was reduced to only half a billion dollars. So they've only been fined one-tenth of the original fine for punitive damage. And that's the kind of money that they can put into their financial considerations and say in our cash flow, allow $500,000 for the big spills that we know are going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's no doubt. It's inevitable.
And the only way is to sign the petition. If we get a law, then they can't do it. That's the only way.
Mm-hmm. And I saw this morning on BNN that one of the companies, oil companies, had made a profit of $1 billion.
Yeah.
Was it for a quarter?
Probably. Yeah.
Sure, with the price of oil going up the way it has been, they're making money hand over fist, and which allows them to invest more in these sorts of developments, because the profits are astronomical. And so that, they can come up with the money to build this pipeline and other development. And now they're talking about the North Slope, right, of Alaska, and a pipeline going from there down to northern Alberta. That, you must have heard about that in the last couple of weeks. That's the next mega project in this part of the world.
Wow.
Things don't get better, do they?
No.
Get worse and worse. Yeah. Any other points you want to make?
Well, I just want to say, like a year ago actually, Bill heard about that. You know, contacted by the. It was really a Dogwood Society, Dogwood Initiative,
mm-hmm.
And so he found out that this whole thing was happening again, and he started creating his web page, and he really got into this. And I kept thinking, oh, it is hopeless. Like, why bother? You know.
And then I
remembered the words of a dear friend of ours, Bob Hunter, who's passed away since. But he's saying that just one person, you know, like it's everyone's responsibility to join the fight, you know, against if you think that something is not right. Mm-hmm. And so just by signing the petition at notankers.ca is all anybody has to do to become part of it.
Notankers.ca.
Like, I know it seems hopeless, and it's, you know, but we all have to do our little part, and that would definitely be a birthday present to BC.
Day. BC Day on August the 4th is also the anniversary of the 150th anniversary of BC becoming a colony of Britain. And so it's its birthday. And a great birthday present, as Linda said, would be to do your thing for BC, save its coast by signing the petition. That's all I'm asking. Please sign the petition at notankers.ca. And if you want some background info, check it out at www.bcwaters.org.
Yeah, splendid idea. Hope there's a lot of followers that actually do that.
So maybe we can just zero in on some of the animals, the fisheries, the salmon that could be affected there. How strategic is that
area? Well, we're talking about spawning runs for all the four, the pink and all the salmon, the spawning grounds.
Then there's the orca, there's the minke whale.
Humpback whales are up there.
I think everything is up there.
Eagles.
This is the pristine, you know, part of BC.
They have not only 10 provincial parks, but there's also, quote, protected areas. Now, what is the BC government who is totally behind this thing? Why do they call them protected areas if they're going to have super tankers going by right on the shorelines of these protected marine parks?
And it's the eagles and the other birds and the future generations of the eagle. For instance, an eagle will eat an infected herring and will take it back and will, you know, either die or, its offspring will be polluted, infected. It's like once it's in the chain, that's it. And there's
then it's in our
plant
food supply, too. And well, it's carcinogenic. Yeah. Oil is carcinogenic.
So it's every animal. And there's so many lodges up there, too. I'm surprised that there's not I haven't heard a bigger outcry from people whose livelihood depend on the BC waters up there.
We would expect, even the tourist industry
should
get on board.
The grizzly bears, anybody that eats the salmon is going to be affected. Or, the native people up there who use the clam fishery.
Certainly should be some clamor coming from Victoria and the BC government, shouldn't there?
There should be.
Maybe they got the wrong perspective on
things. But they're the ones who want to lift the moratorium on exploration of oil on the Charlottes, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that another thing that's looming in the horizon
that
here?
That is, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you've got a port and the super tankers, you're all set, aren't you, for that? More ready than ever, so we could expect.
So anyway, in terms of this pipeline we're talking about from Alberta through to Kitimat, where is it now in terms of the development? Like, do they have their permits? Are they ready to start digging the trenches and putting pipeline in?
Personally, I haven't been there. I don't know. I've been reading the starting with February 22nd of this year was their press release that they're and coincidentally on the same day the federal government announced another grant to the oil industry.
right. So they need grants, right?
Yeah.
Like a starving organization, right?
Yeah.
Incredible, isn't it? The profit that industry makes.
I'm just talking about the astronomical profits of the oil industry, and it's right, like the tar sands. I mean, they're getting subsidized. Mm-hmm. With the profit those companies are making, they're making multi-billion dollar profits, and they're still getting federal subsidies. It's, if people, you kind of really knew about it, if people, Canadian people understood this, I think a lot of people might get upset, but it's like it's not getting, you don't hear much about it in the evening news, and it's not getting into people's consciousness that large numbers of tax dollars are going to these multinational oil companies, which are making huge profits because of the price of oil. And people know when they go to the gas pump that they're paying, double what they were for gas, and it's not getting through to their heads that at the same time the federal government is giving money to the oil companies.
Yeah.
Great.
Robert Kennedy recently said that we would solve our energy problems and the CO2 problems if we took all the subsidies that we give to the coal industry, trillions, and the billions to the oil industry, and give it to alternative energy, finished,
right.
No
yeah.
more.
Right.
Ganz klar. All problems solved.
Well, it sounds like a good solution, Carl. There's a lot of political reasons why it's not happening, I guess.
If you want to try and get something up on the computer, I don't know, if you can get the sound playing, I have it on the board here. So. There, it's coming through.
Good.
You need headphones.
BC waters, rolling oceans, don't want no super tankers hanging around. From sea to shining sea, slick to slip, don't want no super tankers hanging around. The oil men, they don't give a damn, they'll do it every time. Risk the whole environment to save themselves a dime. BC waters, fishing's plenty, Don't need no super tankers crossing my line. BC Waters, ooh, how we love ya. Don't let them do it, we can stop them in time. Don't let them do it, we can stop them in time. Don't let them do it, we can stop them.
In time.
great.
Super. We wrote that song back in 1977 when we blockaded all the politicians who were having their annual meeting aboard the Princess Patricia, and the oilmen had contributed $25,000 towards the cost of the annual convention if they took the Princess Pat, a 350-foot ship, up the Douglas Channel to show what a great place this would be for a superport. So Greenpeace, and we're on the crew, we block and all the fishermen and the natives blockaded the Princess Pat. And would you believe it? The Princess Pat charged through and didn't stop at the blockade. Two of our guys went under the Princess Pat and nearly died. And this is the way the oil men treat us. And in those days, it was such bad publicity for them that 2 weeks later they canceled their plans.
Wonderful. What a victory, huh?
Yeah.
You were certainly elated in Greenpeace.
Well, to know it's back again.
Well, I know. You have to keep fighting. That's the thing. And not lose heart.
Yeah, that was actually one of the most successful Greenpeace campaigns that had ever occurred.
Wonderful. That's
Greenpeace
great.
Greenpeace 7. Greenpeace 9.
Okay, I guess we're going to have to wind this up now. How about repeating the website once again?
The petition, the most important thing is sign the petition at www.notankers.ca, and that link is sponsored by the Dogwood Initiative in Victoria. And my website is at www.bcwaters.org, and that's what has all the facts about this issue.
Wonderful. Thank you so
much. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wonderful of you to come in and keep your spirits up.
Thank you.
Keep up the good fight.
Well, with people like you around, it's not hard.
It isn't. Oh, good. Good. Now, let me just say, you have been listening to an interview with Bill and Linda Gannon, two environmental activists who are working hard to prevent the pipeline from Alberta to tar sands to Kitimat, B.C., so that we're delighted that they were able to come in and inspire us today. I hope that the listening audience is going to do the right thing and put their name on the petition.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
I'm just going to play a few seconds of music, and then our next guest is on the phone ready to go.
Okay.
Record sale on Sunday, July 27th from noon till 5 p.m. Part of Britannia's Artful Sundays at Napier Square on the Drive. We will help kick off 6 Sundays of a multimedia arts market including local artists, workshops, demonstrations, and live music. For more information, visit BritanniaCenter.org.
That's this Sunday at Britannia Center to check out Co-op Radio's book and record sale. It is now 12:30. This is CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM. Co-opradio.org is the website, and there's an archive there. If you want to hear the program again, you can go there and hear it again. But now, off to Carl and our next guest.
Yes, and many of our programs can be heard on our webpage, animalvoices.org. Barbara Cartwright is the campaign manager for the International Fund for Animal Welfare, commonly known as IFAW.org. Welcome to Animal Voices, Barbara.
Thank you very much, Carl.
Yes, and you're speaking to us from Ottawa.
Absolutely, Ottawa, Ontario, yeah.
Great. Well, now, one of your special campaigns is to deal with the ivory trade. And it's maybe you can just tell us something, why you've taken that issue up.
Well, the International Fund for Animal Welfare, or as IFA as we're known, of course, works to protect both wildlife and domestic animals around the world. And we work on that by protecting them against commercial trade, protecting their habitats, and assisting animals in crisis and distress. And elephants come under all three of those. As you just mentioned, they're victims of the ivory trade, the trade in their tusks. They certainly are suffering greatly from a shrinking habitat and lack of protected habitat. And because of the killing specifically for the tusks, they are animals in distress. So elephants are a natural species that we need to protect. And, of course, they're endangered species as well.
Now, there's been the trade is enormous, the tonnage. Maybe you can just tell us how many tusks are involved and where?
Well, right now, it is illegal to trade in ivory. The elephants are protected under the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species. And under that convention, it's a worldwide convention with more than 170 countries signed onto it. So internationally, the world has decided we need to protect elephants. They're endangered, so there should be no trade in their ivory, which specifically makes their population go down. Unfortunately, there still continues to be this illegal trade in ivory, and particularly in countries like Japan and China, there's a large thirst for ivory. And right now, they're able to estimate that 20,000 elephants a year are still dying because of the illegal ivory that's being seized at the borders. So, for example, they have seized between 2004 and 2005, they seized 26 tons of illegal ivory. And it's commonly thought in enforcement, with enforcement officers, that they're probably only seeing about 10% of the real trade. So that equates to about 20,000 animals a year just for the ivory, the illegal ivory that we're seizing.
Now there was a suspension of the trade. What was that about, the 9 years? So there's a moratorium for 9 years, is it? And what does it cover?
Well, exactly. So in 1989, the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES as it's known, made a decision that ivory would no longer be tradable on the market in order to give elephant populations a chance to recover. Unfortunately, starting in the late 90s, four southern African countries, Zimbabwe, Namibia, Botswana, and South Africa, started asking to sell what they call these stockpiles that they have from elephants that they've either culled or have died naturally. CITES allowed a one-off sale of this, and it drove this thirst for more, and so now they're going to allow another sale, and yet it's impossible to tell the difference between legal ivory, quote-unquote, and illegal ivory. There's no way to mark it. So what you just asked about, those 9 years, IFA worked very hard at a recent convention of the parties, so all the signatories to CITES came together. They do every couple of years to talk about the convention. And IFA worked with many organizations and many countries to put a 9-year moratorium in place that there will be no more conversations about selling ivory, because every time we talk about it, more elephants in the wild die because illegal poachers know that this quote-unquote legal ivory is going to allow them to launder lots of illegal ivory through the market. So fortunately for the elephants, CITES agreed. And so once this next sale happens, which is going to happen to China and Japan, there'll be no more discussions at CITES for 9 years on ivory. So the elephants will get a break.
Now, countries like Zimbabwe, and they were the ones involved to want to permit the sale of ivory from culled animals. So, on the pretext that it would be that the money would be used for elephant conservation. But we know a little bit about what's happening in Zimbabwe. Is this truthful, or is it enforceable?
Well, exactly. That's a great question, Carl. How can we know, especially in a country like Zimbabwe that is in the middle of unrest, how do we know where the money is going back to? There is no way to tell. That is one of the issues that IFA has, is that you cannot tell the difference between legal and illegal ivory, and we cannot guarantee that money, especially when it's going into countries that are experiencing unrest, is actually going to conservation or to the protection of elephants in any way, shape, or form. And, of course, a live animal is definitely worth more than a dead one. As you know, and I think all our listeners out there would agree, people go to Africa all the time to see elephants, and so it's a huge ecotourism, obviously. And Kenya itself earned $883 million U.S. dollars annually from their ecotourism. So I think the argument is very strong that we can't tell how the money goes back into conservation, and a live elephant is worth far more to local communities than a dead one.
So this poaching is horrendous, because it really does put the long-term survival of these elephants at stake. The imagine like in olden days when the first white people came to Africa, they stood on top of put a foot on the elephant and with a gun by their side, but it's much more insidious now, because you know they shoot the animal, take the tusks, and then what happens to the animal? I mean, they break the family units. I mean, elephants are. Maybe you can say something about that.
Absolutely. Elephants live in herds. They're highly social, very complex network. Their herds are usually 12 to 16 elephants. They're matriarchal. And so if you're a female, you're born into the herd, you stay in that herd. If you're male, once you hit sexual prime, you move on about 8 years old. And there's many, many, many documented scientific studies on the social nature and relationships, long-term relationships between elephants. So you can imagine how devastating it would be to have one of your herd killed. And I can give you some examples of not only how wonderful and social they are with each other, but also with other animals, the altruistic nature. I would even go as far to say as elephants. So, for example, we probably all heard about the fact that elephants grieve when another elephant is killed. And not only do they grieve, they pick up, once they've identified that that elephant has passed away, they pick up grasses and they put them on top of it. They put tree branches over it. And then they will continue to go back and visit that site where the elephant is, and the dead elephant is. They're also very, very interested in elephant bones. So when one elephant meets another, one of the ways they greet each other is to take their trunks and rub the teeth of the other elephant with their trunks. Hmm. When they find elephant bones, particularly jaws, they'll run over them and over them and over them. And one scientist had moved an elephant jaw from where it had laid to rest to her camp to study. And once she left that camp, she left that jaw behind. Now, her and her kids, many months later, were coming through that same area again, and a baby elephant was beside that jaw, stroking it, and wouldn't leave it. And the only thing they could conclude is that that might have been, or he thought that that was his mother. So they have long-term memory, they have very close ties, they mourn their dead. And then, of course, I think one of the most wonderful stories, and one that some people might have heard before, is about an example of an altruistic behavior with elephants. There was a watering hole in Kenya, and there was a mother rhinoceros and her baby rhinoceros. And the baby rhinoceros had gotten mired in the mud and couldn't get out. And for whatever reason, the mother rhinoceros hadn't really registered that. And a herd of elephants had come down, and one of the large bulls, a male, tried to assist by using his trunks and his tusks to get the baby out of the mud. And the mother rhinoceros would run at the bull and scare him away, and he would go away, and the mother would calm down, and the bull would come back in and try again to lift the baby up, wrap his trunk around it, and get it out. But then the mother rhinoceros would come again and protect her baby from what she perceived was a threat. This bull kept this up all night until people were able to mount and rescue and pull the baby rhinoceros out. I think that's a phenomenal example of the social nature and the altruistic nature of elephants.
When I see pictures of elephant herds, you always see the baby in the center.
Yeah.
They're protecting the young. I mean,
yeah.
It's just so amazing. We can learn so much from the animals.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you've ever seen this in the wild, but when I was actually down in southern Africa a few years back, a large female herd was coming across the plain, and when they came to the road, they knew that the road meant danger, and so they grouped all the babies into the middle. There was about three of them. All the babies got in the middle. The matriarch sounded her trumpet, and then they all crossed the road, and then they dispersed afterwards. It's quite phenomenal.
Barbara, Alan has a question.
Yes. One of the justifications for the ivory trade and culling the elephant herds is that the overpopulation of elephants is a big problem, and the elephants destroy farmers' fields and that sort of thing. How is this really a problem, and how is it being addressed if it is?
Well, it's important to remember first this concept that elephants are overpopulated isn't true. Elephants are an endangered species. All but a few of the African populations are listed under the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species as Appendix 1, or in other words, they're afforded the highest possible status. Now, there's in some of the southern countries, particularly South Africa, where the elephants are fenced in because now they're only in parks, there is this concern that there are too many for the amount of space they're afforded inside the fence. So that's not an overpopulation. We have to look at, obviously, the population as a metapopulation, which is endangered. So what we have to do is deal with the mitigated amount of habitat that they have. Right now, IFA is working closely with some universities down in South Africa to look at how we can drop those fences and open up metaparks, or megaparks as they're called, so that we can create more habitat for those elephants so they're not crunched in. Of course, the other thing is studies are starting to show that it's not just a matter of they're overpopulated, it's rather where artificial water holes have been put together, how farming practices happen. It's far more complex. And of course, killing an endangered species is not the solution to helping the population, both the human population and the animal population.
In the book Elephant Breakdown, Bradshaw wrote in Nature, and he said that there was the elephant populations are suffering from a form of chronic stress, a kind of species-wide trauma. Decades of poaching and culling and habitat loss, they claim, have so disrupted the intricate web of familial and societal relationships of the elephants. I think it's very, very well put. But what can be done here? You people, the IFAW, that's IFAW.org, International Fund for Animal Welfare. What can people do? You have a great web page there.
Absolutely. Certainly, I invite anyone to come to our web page. There's an entire section specifically on elephants. If you want to learn more about elephants, come there and the different threats they face. As far as what we can do as individuals, obviously the first thing is never buy ivory. If you see ivory in a tourist market, and they sometimes try to tell you it's a different type of ivory, or it's just bone, they'll call it, don't buy it. It's very important that we don't buy wildlife tourist trinkets, because they always mean that an animal died to create them, regardless to whether it's ivory or not. But for elephants in specific, obviously don't buy ivory. Encourage ecotourism. Encourage people to go and see elephants with a camera and take pictures of them. And then, of course, if you want to protect elephants, if you want to donate funds to elephants, there's several groups, and IFA certainly welcomes donations. And then we need research. We need to find out, as I was saying earlier, what do we need to do in order to increase habitat for elephants and decrease human-wildlife conflict, which is a very serious problem both for the elephants and the people. There's no doubt that the elephants and the people are in conflict. We have to resolve that conflict without either party being harmed.
Now, Barbara Cartwright, earlier you mentioned that Japan and China are now permitted to bid on the stock sales of culled animals. And the culling, of course, is just. I mean, let me ask it this way: is Canadians can still import ivory from other countries? Is that still permitted?
No, you can't outright. You can't just bring in ivory. If you have a piece of ivory, or you've unfortunately purchased a piece of ivory, which I go back to my earlier comment, which is never buy ivory at all for any reason. It has to be, in order for it to come into Canada, it has to be accompanied by what's known as a CITES permit. So the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species actually permits the piece and says this has been antique ivory. So it's ivory that was carved before 1989, which is when the ban on the trade in ivory started. That's the only way you can bring it in. And you also have to have an export permit from the country you bought it in.
Good. So there are some legislation in place.
There is. Unfortunately, it doesn't stop people from smuggling it. It doesn't stop people from buying it and just not bothering to get the permits and just carrying it across, wearing it across. There's lots of ways. If you want to move it, unfortunately, you can.
So people would go to China or Japan where it could be on the market and bring it back here. They'd find themselves in trouble.
Yes, as well as in Africa. If you go into some of the markets in Africa, you are going to see carved items, and you're going to ask them what they are, and they're going to say it's bone. Don't buy it.
Barbara, in closing, Marge has a question.
I have one brief question. I'm thinking about ivory. When I think of the use of ivory in our society over the years, it's been piano keys, for one thing. Are companies still importing ivory for piano keys, or is that something that's passé?
Not to my knowledge. They do have a synthetic that they use. You do have antique, obviously, pianos that have ivory keys.
Yes.
And my understanding is the ivory sound is considered superior, so you have to get an antique one. But the current new ones are not ivory. They couldn't be. They couldn't get that kind of ivory.
I'm good. I'm glad to hear that.
Thank you, Barbara Cartwright. You're the spokesperson for the International Fund for Animal Welfare, and your particular issue is the ivory trade and saving the animals. Thank you for being on Animal Voices.
Wonderful, an absolute pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Bye for now, Barbara.
Bye.
And you're listening to Animal Voices on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. Many of our programs are listed on our webpage, animalvoices.org.
Yes, and now, Alan, could we have a little music?
The jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. In the jungle,
please hang on to enjoy your
jungle. The lion sleeps tonight. Hush, my baby, don't fear, my darling. The lion sleeps tonight. Hush, my baby, don't fear, my darling. The lion sleeps tonight.
Ladysmith Black Mambazo, music about lions from South Africa. And here's another animal from South Africa, Carl.
That's me, yes. And in Central Africa, you say, when you meet somebody in Tanzania or Kenya, you say jumbo. And of course here it means jumbo is the elephant.
Yeah, right. I think it's time for a laugh. And I've got one from an Irish friend. I'm going to read it very short, but Paddy was driving down the street in a sweat because he had an important meeting and couldn't find a parking space. Looking up to heaven, he said, "Lord, take pity on me. If you find me a parking place, I'll go to the Mass every Sunday for the rest of my life and give up my Irish whiskey." Miraculously, a parking place came almost immediately. Paddy looked up again and said, "Never mind, I found one."
Well, you know, we have some good news too, and this is time that the Spanish government has passed a resolution that grants basic legal rights to great apes. If the bill passes, Spain will be required to adhere to the principles of the Great Ape Project, which points to apes' humans' qualities, and including that the apes are able to feel fear, experience happiness, create tools, use languages, remember the past, and plan the future. I'm convinced that we only beginning to discover everything that these animals can do and how similar they are in many ways to us. Well, you know, in this last edition of Good Medicine from the the PCRM.org, Physicians Committee Responsible for Medicine, they said that there's progesterone in dairy products. I was really quite surprised about that. And that this progesterone in the dairy products may increase breast cancer risk. And it says here in the magazine, and there's some 5,000 medical practitioners who are members of the Physicians Committee for Responsible, and it says consuming high-fat dairy products may increase breast cancer risk because of high levels of bovine progesterone, according to a study presented at the annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. Anyway, that's a point of interest there from PCRM.org, a great web page that views things from a professional medical society. Well, in its last People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, in their last their last Animal Times, there was a wonderful article about lobsters. Ingrid Newkirk wrote this wonderful story. She said, one day, many years ago, I was taken to the famous lobster restaurant in Philadelphia for my birthday, and I remember feeling very romantic and happy that evening. The waiter brought on a silver tray to the table, and on it were some fine-looking lobsters. The waiter invited me to select one. The lobsters waved their antennae at me. I picked one. Boiled or broiled? Asked the waiter. Broiled, I said, without hesitation. Back then, I had no idea that it is standard to slit open the lobster's back, to pour salt and butter into the wound, and then place him on the burning grill and slide him alive under the hot broiler. The lobster returned to the table. I cracked open the leg and pulled out a mound of buttery flesh, squeezed lemon onto it, and popped it into my mouth. Perhaps it was because he had tried in his pathetic way to communicate what was a plea, a threat. But when I look back, that first bite, it hit me. It was no different from the people in China who point to the puppies in the hanging cage and pick out the one to eat. I had paid no more attention to these animals waving their antennae. So that's Ingrid Newkirk from People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
There was a good news lobster story. Maybe you saw it in the news in the last few days. This huge lobster was caught off eastern Canada, and it's estimated to be more than 100 years old. Like, they live for a long time. It was this giant lobster. So this fish dealer got a hold of it, and he was offered $1,000 by some restaurant who wanted it so they could present this huge lobster and charge a lot of money. But unfortunately, It started in Vancouver. Somebody in Vancouver heard about this, and he offered $1,000. He said, rather than the restaurant, I'll give you $1,000, put the lobster back in the water. And then this hit the news, and then other people started offering money, and pretty soon this guy was being offered $5,000 by various people to save the lobster and put it back in the water. So he ultimately decided that he agreed that the lobster should not end up in a restaurant, even though the restaurant was the first one to approach him. And so what's happening now is the lobster is going to some center for it. Apparently, it wouldn't live if, because it's been in captivity. It wouldn't live if it was just dumped back in the ocean. So it's being given a new home in the East Coast somewhere, in some research center or something. So this lobster, you know, will live maybe for another 100 years. Who knows? But it was great that this guy in Vancouver heard about this, picked up the ball, and offered $1,000 to save this lobster.
Absolutely.
You know, when
yeah.
I go to the store, a supermarket, and I see these lobsters and they have their claws tied, and to me it fills me with absolute sadness at the absolute cruelty of these lobsters, you know, and that they clip their antennae too, and then they also, that lobsters actually in their lifetime not only live to be 100 years, as you said, but cover a great distance, a great territory. And here they are in this little tank, one piled up on top of another, and people perceive it as an absolute delicacy. And I would just love to see this banned, just totally, that, you know, it's removed from these stores as a desirable item, and people need to be educated, I feel.
Yeah, I'm curious, Alan, about the lobster. It was very, very large, you said,
yeah.
And 100 years old. Does it continue to grow?
Yes.
Until 100 or more, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they continue to grow at the same rate, but they do continue to grow, you know, like they shed their old shell and grow a new one periodically. It'd be interesting to know, though they do get bigger, though. I mean, a lobster that's 10 years old might be 10 pounds, but a lobster that's 100 years old is not 100 pounds, it might be 20 pounds.
Yeah.
So they do continue to grow.
Yeah. Now, lobsters are scavengers, and, and they eat dead matter and they eat fecal matter. And it was said that with the sewage system as it is under the Lions Great Bridge, that people eating those lobsters, because they're eating the feces from humans, it would be possible to eat your own excrement by eating these lobsters.
We don't have lobsters in British Columbia. We have crabs.
Crabs.
We have wonderful Dungeness crabs, as big crabs you see in the crab stores, which amazes me that people would keep, you know, flying out lobsters all the way from Maritime Canada, where there is local shellfish here. But I mean, that's, you know, beyond the, you know, aside from the point of whether or not you should be eating these animals anyway. But it's strange that that you have these great local shellfish. But of course, Carl is right that you do see people in local waters here crab fishing, and they don't really think about what they're getting. Same as people, you go down to Stanley Park and you can see people who are fishing for flatfish, for flounders, and other flatfish around there, and they're eating what you're talking about. You know,
yeah, you don't want to mention it, but I will mention that this coming Sunday at the Jericho Park East, Earth Save Canada is having a potluck on the beach this coming Sunday at 6 p.m. Rain or shine, I ask everybody to be there.
Lobster,
it's a great, great event, and there won't be any lobster. It's totally vegan. You can go to earthsave.ca. And have a look at the event there. A great place to meet wonderful, like-minded people.
We're out of time.
Okay, we're out of time.
Sorry.
So I've got to close.
Yep.
Thank you for listening to Animal Voices on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio. Please join us again next week at 12 noon on Friday. We'll be back.